as an industry or in multiple industries, blockchain, smart contracts, data oracles, all sort of coupled together and sort of laid in the way that they are, you've got a really sophisticated way to deliver better automation to many, many industries. It doesn't really matter what industry it is. You know, I can name probably 20 right off the top of my head of industries that I've had some sort of engagement with that are looking for automation, really basic automation on contracts, settlement, whatever it might be. And those tools exist today.
That is Jake Denny, and this is episode 41 of the Blockchain Pro podcast. Welcome to episode 41 of the Blockchain Pro podcast. I'm Adriana Bellotti, and today's guest is Jake Denny. Jake's career has been super interesting, having started in the entertainment industry, transitioning to the digital domain with music and apps, and now into crypto. In this chat, Jake recounts his digital transformation journey and how crypto is the next natural step in the evolution of the internet. Let's get to know Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for taking the time to have this chat. Absolutely. I was doing some research on you, like stalking your LinkedIn profile, and I was pretty stoked by the recommendations that people have done for you. And, you know, how they talk about you and, you know, how much you've helped people along your career. That was like such an amazing fact that I didn't know about. So I'm really glad that I did that research. And you've led a pretty interesting career that did not start in crypto. So let's go back in time and talk a little bit about what you were doing before falling down the crypto rabbit hole.
Sure. Yes. Okay. Well, really the fairest place to start in terms of like career would be the desire to work in the music industry. I have loved music since I can remember anything about life. And that was always sort of an obsession for me, was music. Any job that I had in high school was all about saving up money to go and buy records, cassettes, and eventually CDs. And so for me, it was very much had to get involved somehow, had to find a way in. And so for me, the real start was a career in the music industry. I started my own company. I was helping local music bands, some national bands, working on a bunch of concerts that I used to put on when I was a teenager, did a bunch of things that sort of, you know, it got decent enough in size and attracted enough people. And that sort of took me on a journey into one of the largest music agents in the country. We represented some of the largest talent in the Australian market, brought out some international artists as well. That was a great experience, learning how to think on your feet at a very, very young age. And, you know, that was certainly a journey. Very hard, long hours, lots of concerts, which is great, lots of fun. But yeah, really hard work. And it was largely a analog world. I remember this was, email was a new thing. You'd check the emails maybe once a week because that was about the response rate you'd get. You'd run big books of diaries and the diaries of the contacts that you'd have at the venues and everything else. It was very much an analog universe that we were running at that time. And it worked. It did great. From there, I sort of jumped into the recorded music side. So for me, my sort of ultimate dream was working in Hollywood at Capitol Records. And so that was sort of this vision I had as a young kid of eventually going to do that. So when an opportunity sort of emerged at EMI, representing Capitol Records, Virgin Records, Disney Records and the like, I quickly jumped at that. And worked my way through, you know, some various things on the consumer marketing side, which was very sort of consistent with what I'd been doing on the touring side previously to that, and also within my own business with promoting and helping with the management of bands. But you know, the exciting thing sort of came in this unexpected area of digital. No one wanted to touch it. No one in the music industry wanted to go near this thing of digital. It was sort of like this unknown, strange animal that looked like the death of the industry. People were definitely talking about peer-to-peer file sharing and all the evils that brought. It was theft. It was the, you know, criminal networks. It was lots of heavy discussions around, you know, the impending doom that they might bring to the industry. And so it was very much seen as a fearful space. And I was a young person at the time. I just thought, if there was going to be ever a fast way to accelerate your career at a big international company, that would be one way, is to jump on that boat. So when they announced globally that they were going to start hiring these global roles, I immediately put my hat in the ring and said, I don't know a lot about digital, but I did do some programming as a kid, and I'm willing to learn what else I need to jump down that. And so that was very much the start of my digital obsession, I would say. So that was, yeah, that was probably where it all started. It was about designing supply chains for this new digital ecosystem. It was working with the manufacturers of handsets and telcos to, you know, get content out. It was global supply chains, coordinating with, I worked very closely with Apple and Cupertino to launch the iTunes store in Australia, which was a great experience. I think we had about two false starts before we eventually launched in the Australian market. But we did well. It got people thinking about things differently. The information on what people actually wanted versus what we'd always thought that they wanted or should have was a very sobering experience for the industry. And so that was a really, really great learning curve for me and for a lot of other people on that sort of journey. And having sort of done a lot of things in and around the music space, I decided to sort of end that period of my life by going touring around the world with the Australian rock band Silverchair, who I'd worked with at various points. I went to the same school as those guys, was good friends with them. So there was a bit of a commonality there. Was working on their tours and had worked on their record. And so it made sense to sort of jump on and go around the world with them and do, the European, North American tours. And we did the big Across the Great Divide tour with Powderfinger as well. So it was a great experience. It was a great sort of cherry on that part of my life. And then I needed to go and work out what else to do. And so then I went media side. And so that was Dynamsn, at the time, largest media company in Australia, as the joint venture between PBL Media and Microsoft. And so I think at one point, I remember the stat that we used to roll out was 69% of all Australians logged in to the internet via Dynamsn. So we were really the one way to access. This is prior to sort of Google being default of everything. And it was certainly prior to anybody using Facebook at any level of scale. And so that was a really good experience. And my very specific role, or at least focus there, was on mobile technology. And that was, again, one of those areas that was looking interesting. Payments in particular was my number one obsession there, with how you get people to pay for things using mobile devices and what that was changing in terms of consumer behavior. So that was sort of where that started. I had very much enjoyed my time in the US traveling with the band and experiencing that country. I'd fallen in love with it. And so made a decision to do what about 20 odd million people around the world do each year, and that's buy a ticket in the green card lottery, and I won. So okay. I immediately became an American resident and made the shift over there. So I jumped over there to the US and worked with a bunch of startup companies in the mobile technology space, eventually becoming a citizen of the US as well. But loved my time in the US, intend to get back there at some point in the future, keep a lot of deep connections and interests there. And so that was sort of the exposure through mobile technology, virtual currency engines inside of gaming platforms, SDKs, you know, all the technical integrations that just sort of occurred. And then this constant push towards automation, as those paths all sort of led to an eventual path, I discovered this thing called Ethereum. And from that point, it was an obsession. It was really this this looks like the future of everything else that I've seen in terms of all the cycles that I've seen. And to not pay a lot of attention to that, to me, seemed like a crime. And so eventually I had to just make the move and basically make that the career decision is, all right, it's time for crypto full time. This is it. Let's go.
So from digital obsession to Ethereum obsession.
Yeah, that's probably a fair way to put it. And it's not just Ethereum. The idea of Bitcoin was pretty enticing as a concept. It's just, you know, in terms of what you could do from a application level or within like an operating system level, Ethereum to me had a lot of appeal. I'd worked obviously very closely with Apple on the early growth of how the iTunes store worked. For me, then following that through to the App Store ecosystem and a lot of the work that I'd done at companies like Tapjoy in the US was very much around apps and distribution and working through those discovery mechanisms, which is really, really hard. There's a lot of competition, a lot of funding coming in. So understanding where Ethereum might eventually head once there was enough capital in the space and once there was enough people building in the space, to me, it looked like this could be a really big sort of app store layer of launching these platforms just with a lot less lift in terms of the underlying infrastructure.
So there's a big parallel there between the early stages of the digital space and how it developed to the early stages of the crypto space and how it's developing now and how crypto is bringing this transfer value layer to the digital space that previously wasn't there, right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I know when we're at when I was at the company Tapjoy in New York, we had this great marketing leader, Peter Dilley. He'd come over and joined us from Sony PlayStation. He was in a very senior role over there and had a really great sense of consumer marketing and consumer speak. And we'd been coming at this problem from a mobile app discovery, mobile app monetization problem in a pretty boring way, very unsophisticated, very deep tech. You know, we really didn't understand how consumers spoke, and he brought that language to our team. And I remember we'd come up with this idea, the value exchange. And so everything we spoke about, and this was the idea that consumers would engage by watching ads in exchange for access to games or utilities in the games. And this notion of value exchange, when you really understand it and you really sort of get deeper on what that means, there's a really great idea behind what that is. And then from there, you know, and we're talking, this was probably 2011, we'd sort of gone down that path. If you were sort of to follow that trajectory in terms of the metrics of focus and attention and value and exchange, is we very much sort of led down to this path of, you know, attention being at the forefront of what you're exchanging. You know, you want people to pay attention to things, but you can't do that unless you first have their attention. And so I think, you know, what is the fair exchange of attention? You know, where does that head? And I think that's, you know, for me, that was really sort of where I saw that culmination of like, okay, crypto can go down this path and we can do that, but we've got to be able to get outside of the pure tech speak. And we've got to understand what are people actually getting, you know, in their experiences in using these things? Like, where is that value creation? What is that exchange look like?
Yeah, I see what you mean. So I think there's a lack of clear communication within the blockchain space to express the potential, right? And it's yes. Hard to talk to people that are not involved in this, like on the daily basis. How do you explain what DeFi is and what's the value in that? So how do you do that with, you know, the people that are in your network that are not necessarily in crypto yet, but you know that they can benefit from it in, you know, the longer term?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think, you know, like you even said, like DeFi, like what even is that? Industries love acronyms and they love to throw them around. The deep industry speak is part of the barrier that industries put up to try and keep others out, right? It's the idea of that, you know, if you become familiar enough with the vernacular of how we speak, then you're allowed in the tent. If you don't, then you're on the outside, and that's sort of it. And that's every industry, right? Every industry has that approach. I think with crypto, it's blockchain more generally, it isn't an industry. It isn't one thing. And so the challenge is the crypto community and the blockchain space has created these terms and these phrases. Now, that they're very true to what it does and what it can do. But the thing is that they're forgetting who they're talking to. Because if they're trying to engage in a particular area, games, finance, agriculture, data, whatever it might be, as they're engaging in that conversation, who are they trying to bring on board? Who are they trying to get excited about that from outside of the community? Got to get outside of the echo chamber. And so I think that's where you can lose a lot of people, is explaining what is the value here? Like, what, why would I care? You know, I've worked with some great sales leaders at various things. And there was, numerous people, and they would always say, one of the hardest thing in sales to do, and it doesn't matter whether you're the CEO or the head of sales, the hardest thing to do is very clearly communicate what is your offering, what is it that you're actually presenting me with that would get me excited, what is your unique property, what is the angle here. So like very clearly communicating that, I think it's difficult for people to distill that within the crypto space, because people are just still trying to work out what it is. It's like, yeah, smart contracts are cool, but like, what have you solved today, and who did you solve that for? And if it's somebody else who's just within the crypto community, you've probably missed a good consumer opportunity there. And that's the challenge, is how do we move from where we are today to the bigger en masse? It's the, it's crossing the chasm, like, how do we do that? That's the real challenge here, is getting to mainstream audience.
So how do you think we should do that? How?
Yeah, I wish I had that answer. I think you couldn't possibly attempt to try and solve it all in one simple answer. I think it's a death by a thousand cuts. I think,
all right, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, of course.
So you cannot answer that in one go. So let me rephrase that. What are you doing and the business that you're working with doing to try and, help bridge this gap?
Sure. So within the context of what we do at Mycelium, or at least how we're trying to tell the story specific to our products and companies and our solutions, is we're focusing on a very particular market or a very particular type of customer, and we're trying to deliver value for them. And so that might be, and you can't just say, hey, we're going to save you time, because a lot of people don't understand time well enough to understand the value of time. And so you've got to find something else. What did you do? Like, are you going to save me money? People are interested in saving money. Are you going to give me a better experience? People like a better experience, but they also like a better experience for less money. So like, what can you solve? Now, what people really love is they love more information. They love insights. They love the power in that. They love the access. And so, at various things, like we built for the Chainlink community, reputation.link, which is the Chainlink Oracle reputation. And it is basically a way to visualize the data of everything that's going on within the Chainlink community. And that is just the delivery of data. Now, I've worked very closely with companies like IBM and Oracle in the US and Canada, and MasterCard and others, where we were constantly working in the data realms. And it was sort of, you'd go and you'd fetch the data, you'd store it locally, and then you'd call it into, various instances, and you would use it. But you had to trust the information that you're paying for. You're paying for it. You had to pay for it in every instance that you were using it or calling it, within the commercial terms of your agreement. And then, forget about it or otherwise. And so there was a lack of sort of control or accountability in terms of the true state of that data, whether it was immutable or not, whether you could change it. And so they're just inherent problems with the data universe, where the blockchain has sort of solved, in particular, the public blockchains like Ethereum, is this immutable state, this idea that you can deliver that and you cannot change the state of that particular event. It's always there. It's historically recorded forever in that exact version. And so you can go back on that and you can look at that and you can say, well, that's what we did. And so you think about that in terms of what companies like Chainlink are solving around that delivery of a better way to deliver data to the industry. Is you then think about, well, how do smart contracts work within the context of blockchains? And all of a sudden you have the automation structures there, but then you've also got a cleaner way and a more trustworthy way of delivering the information. So once again, you can sort of see where, as an industry or in multiple industries, blockchain, smart contracts, data oracles, all sort of coupled together and sort of laid in the way that they are, you've got a really sophisticated way to deliver better automation to many, many industries. It doesn't really matter what industry it is. You know, I can name probably 20 right off the top of my head of industries that I've had some sort of engagement with that are looking for automation, really basic automation on contracts, settlement, whatever it might be. And those tools exist today. And so I think that's a really fascinating thing is when we look at those problems and we look at sort of getting granular into that, that's a problem we can solve right now. And so if we find the people that we can solve those problems for today, and they can see that value and they're willing to share that value, pass that value onto their customers, whatever it might be, that is probably where one of the best approaches is to constantly deliver that value to our customers so we can prove that there's a business there, but also their consumers can benefit from some of those, you know, cost efficiencies, you know, speed, whatever it might be, the trustworthy nature of the data, particularly if you've got two people either side of a contract. You know, the conflict on that alone can be resolved in a lot of instances if you know that neither party can go and make any changes to the records of the data that were supplied.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. There's so much still to be done. And, you know, every time we peel a layer, it seems like there's 1,000 layers under that you still have to peel.
The onion.
One of those layers could be talent. Like, it's very hard to find talent, right?
Yes, it is.
What are the most difficult roles that you found? Like, I know that your company is hiring, every company that's in this space is hiring. So where have you found like the, I think where I'm going is like finding developers is hard, but it's not as hard as other things. So where is the difficulty right now?
Look, I think there's a number of different ways to answer that question when it comes to talent, because it's a tough one. I've had the great privilege of working with lots of people, and you know, to your point earlier on, you know, LinkedIn comments and things like that. I think, you know, the building of teams is hard. I mean, I built teams in cities in the US that I had never even visited before, and you know, it is really hard. But it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of getting to know people there. It's getting to know it. You can make mistakes. Like, I can assure you, like, a city like Chicago is a tough city. If you're not from Chicago and you go and you try and build a team and you don't do it the right way, you'll fail. And you'll fail. And when you eventually make friends there, they'll tell you you failed and they'll tell you they noticed that you failed. And if you've got, or you've been able to develop at least some relationships there, as opposed to just hiring people there, they'll guide you along the journey in the future and they'll help you sort of understand how the market dynamics work there. They'll help you understand how to work that market and fit into that market, and then ask you to make the commitment to really make a commitment to it, that you're going to grow and hire people and nurture them there and have a true commitment there. You're not just in there to hire the talent, steal them in, do whatever you need to do and exit your position or your company and what have you. And so I think that when people think about careers, that's a really different thing. I think, you know, we can talk about developers, we can talk about languages like Solidity. That's hard. There's no question. So just start from the basis that this is a young language with a small group of use cases to actually use it. You didn't have the major technology companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft hiring for that particular language. So minus all the capital and the career opportunities for the majority of talent in the market, and deal with, you know, people who actually get what blockchain solves, were interested in this because of the opportunity, the identity, the sense of purpose. They're the people that wanted to get into Solidity early and contribute to Ethereum. And there are other platforms they can do as well. But in particular, you know, Ethereum is unquestionably the largest in terms of developer network and capital and everything else. So if you think about that, that's a challenge. You likely can't find a lot of talent of Solidity developers anywhere in the world, for that matter, who have got lots of experience, who've got lots of life experience, who have got lots of computer, you know, engineering experience as well, right? Like, it's not just knowing Solidity. It is, how do you deal with this crisis? How do you deal with, you know, these very specific things? How do you deal with people? And so, you know, we're looking for talent in that realm, and we're certainly not alone, but the developer community needs to first discover this for themselves and get excited by it. I talk to lots of friends who are developers that aren't in crypto and aren't in blockchain. And, you know, I'm constantly, you know, pushing this idea of like, why not do something that you really love, that you could potentially make a contribution that will be remembered? You're not just contributing to a code base that may, you know, be stacked up against another one who's building exactly the same thing as you to see which one stacks up, or doing something that just hits the cutting room floor. Why not build something that matters? Why not put your name, etch it in stone forever, be part of that legacy? You could build it with Ethereum. That's one of the neat things. And they like the idea of it, but it is the risk. And that's a startup risk. That might not necessarily be a I want to learn or have to learn a new language, or I'm scared of not knowing the most about it. I don't think they have that fear because they've gone and they've learned languages at other companies. It's like, right, I'm going to learn this framework. React is cool. Like, it, you drop that, and that's your you know, immediate alpha at companies like Facebook and Google. And so, you know, there are benefits of that. They do that all the time. They've done that their careers. So I don't think that's the challenge. I think it's more, it's an unknown. Is this going to be a career? Will somebody in 10 years' time look at that and say, oh, that was a good career move? Because people have been wired to think like that. You go to school, you go to university, you graduate, you go into the workforce, and you build this steady career, and LinkedIn indexes perfectly like that. And the resume format is still that sort of fashion. So I think there's just that natural resistance to jumping into startups for all people in all areas. And then the other part, I think this is just more generally for talent, which is what I've found, and lots of smarter people than me have told me this over the years, is good talent has choice. So if you're really good at what you do and you have this advantage of knowledge on the rest of the market or a network that's deeper than others, you always have a choice in the market. Who are you going to work with? Who are you going to work for? Where are you going to take that power that you hold, and where are you going to present it? And the people who have a choice don't have any fear around that. It is very much a decision of where they want to be. And so I think you've got to find, you know, in terms of attracting the right talent, you've got to be really good at explaining what your mission is. And so I think that, you know, that's sort of the obsession that we've really had in the last few months, is, you know, really having a clarity of vision so that we can clearly communicate it to all of the people within the company today and all of the people that we want to join tomorrow. And so if we do that part well, people will understand the mission and say, you know what? I don't really love going to work every day and doing this thing. And, you know, what is a sense of purpose? It's like, you've got, if you take away the time you're asleep, and then you just take the time that you can do the things that you want to do, and you do the job that you do. If you spend that, you know, you're talking about half of your conscious life, really, after you've, you know, factored in weekends and going home and doing other things. And some of those things that you're doing are washing up and, you know, and washing clothes and, you know, dropping kids to school. So they can be whatever. But the other half of your conscious life is at work. And if you don't enjoy what you do, then what are you doing? You're literally wasting half of your life, your conscious life. And so I think that's a very real thing. And so part of our story for the people who want out of that, who want to change and want to do cool stuff, whether you love the idea of NFTs, you're from the arts community, music industry, you're a photographer, you're a designer, that's awesome. Go and do it. There's so many people that are willing to help you now and give you that independence. I mean, go and ask people, right? Like, there is a real opportunity. There are tons of opportunities for people. You're a lawyer and you want to sort of advance your career and think about things differently. If you knew how this space worked and the structures of corporate entities and how you're designing these frameworks and how smart contracts work, there's massive opportunity in that. And so I think it's thinking differently first. And so we need to educate the market. We need to get people excited about the mission. We need to clearly communicate it. And I think if we're successful in doing that, then people are going to want to join companies like ours and others. But I think that they'll get excited by that clarity. That's critical.
Yes. And I think also the opportunity to change things in, you know, in make kind of like make history as crypto history develops. You can be part of, you know, the beginning. How many people get to say, oh, I was there at the beginning of something that is so big?
That's right. That's right. Oh, and look, I mean, one of the trappings I think that we have as an industry, and this is a blessing and a curse to some degree. So if you were very early in buying Bitcoin, for whatever reason you came across it, is irrelevant at this point. As long as if you're still holding it, you're probably very happy with that. You know, same with Ethereum. Look, I mean, even same with Dogecoin, if that's your thing. So like the idea that people could get into these things and access them earlier than usual, they didn't have to go public, and they didn't have to go through and have a ton of the value extracted through, you know, the rounds that they do in, you know, before the banking rounds, before they hit the public markets, you know, unless they're a direct listing or what have you. So minus that, that value extraction event, there has been opportunities for just general people to make money in this space. Now, that's great. That's, you know, well done to them, well done to the vision, but that's not an industry. That's not where people are going to tie their careers. That's not building useful things for consumers. That hasn't done any of those things yet. Vitalik called that out himself, you know, back in the peak of 2017. He's like, we haven't deserved any of these prices or valuations. We've done nothing yet. And there was never a truer statement spoken, and people still ask him about that today. You know, and I think there's definitely been a lot of achievements in the space now that you can see actual working products, but there's a long way to go. And so we've got to get a lot better at separating the speculation around pricing of crypto assets and the actual value being provided through the technology of blockchain.
Yeah, those are two very important distinctions. And I guess these are two ways that the community self-organizes around, you know, meetups and things that happen. And it's like value here, technology here. And sometimes they commingle, but they tend to be very separate as well.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny, like I remember, I mean, look, there was never really any such thing as like a music industry meetup. It was a very sort of insular industry. But if you wanted to sort of be in the know of certain things, you wanted to be where all the people were, there were certain pubs on Wednesdays and Thursday nights that you would go to, and everyone in the music industry in that city would be there. So they were unofficial and sort of rally around a band. In the mobile and media space in particular, the meetups were really critical in the early days of those. And so I think this even probably predated Meetup itself as a platform. But Mobile Mondays were an event that started, you know, over in Europe and, you know, really quickly caught momentum. We used to have them in Sydney. I used to attend them in New York. And it was a lot of people who were early in the days contributing to the ecosystem of building out this idea that mobile would be the future of computing. And the people were committed to that. You know, this was before there was an app store with Apple. You know, this was, you know, pre a lot of these things. It was Symbian Foundation and really early technology, really clunky, fear around regulation, people getting, you know, spammed with premium SMSs and things like that. So there were concerns about regulation. There was concerns of overreach. There was concerns about adoption and standardization and all of these things. And it eventually played out to the point that everyone today predominantly uses mobile devices as their first go-to, you know, computing device. And so it played out. Now, the early meetings, those get-togethers, were critical in terms of bringing the right people together. And there was usually just one banner to put that under. What Meetup has done as a platform that people have typically sort of grabbed onto in terms of coordinating people into rooms on topics is it has allowed people to fragment themselves into these communities, into these micro communities. And so this goes beyond sort of the online stuff that we have with Discord and all these other great tools. This is more the locals. So this is a, you know, outside of COVID restrictions sort of environment. But it was really, really important. But you'll notice within those, like you said, that the rooms are crossing over now. The builders are in a room. The traders are in a room. The traders want to know more about what's being built. The people who are building want to know what the traders want to see in the products that they're building. And so that's a really good use case. Now, what we're starting to see is we're starting to see artists and we're starting to see agents and we're starting to see other people coming into the rooms and asking questions about, you know, what are these NFTs? You know, how would my clients use them or how can I use them? And that's great. Getting the balance right is going to be really important. And so you can just see people are crying out for education. They're desperate to know more about how this works. They're scared of misinformation. There are big risks involved financially if you get it wrong. And so relying on these people who have been early in the blockchain world, building companies, contributing to this space, they're important voices and they can be leaders. So again, you know, the appeal to why you want to come and work in the space is it's so early. You come in here now, you know, potential, you know, fast track your career growth, you know, into, you know, whatever industries are adopting in the future, but also be a leader, you know, come and help people understand that that's a huge opportunity to just take something and make it really easy to understand and accessible to the next person. That's I think a lot of people are rallied to that, you know, the idea of, I think I can help somebody in this space, or I think I can pay this forward. And there are a lot of people who are contributing for no money into this, the goodness of their own heart. They're doing it because they care. And that's, you know, I mean, look at this podcast in itself, like what you've done with getting all these great people together to have these conversations. You know, that's a perfect example. And there are a bunch, but we need more people like you doing that.
We certainly do. And the more the merrier. That's what I believe. I don't see meetups or podcasts as competitors. I see if you're producing quality content that is helping people solve their problems or, you know, make decisions about things that they are reading or, you know, interested in, I think that's a great thing that, you know, anyone can do to contribute.
Absolutely.
All right. Oh, time flew by. I'm introducing in this episode something new that I call quick three. And that's like
quick three, okay.
Quick three to end the podcast. And the quick three are: what are you currently reading? Your favorite crypto tool or online tool, and your favorite project.
Oh, okay. That's great. That's great. That's tough. Okay. So what am I reading? Well, I'm just about to read Michael Lewis's new book, The Premonition. Okay. I just got that delivered the other day, so I'm excited to read that. I love Michael Lewis's stuff. Love his podcast too, but yeah, his writing style is just amazing. So I'm excited about that. I believe that has a lot to do with where we are with pandemics and the like. So that's unrelated to crypto. Best crypto tool.
Oh, but that's
tool.
Good.
That's
a...
yeah, that's right. That's
that, you know, we that are in this industry don't only think about crypto. We have other interests as well.
It's true. Yeah, he has a good take. most of the things have been around finance. But yeah, no, this will be an interesting one. Crypto tools on that one. Look, I mean, like I remember very specifically having my mind blown is that first time that I used the MetaMask app with Uniswap to trade one asset for another. Like just the idea of Web3 logins and the idea of it working on a mobile device as well as on a desktop and it being a single button and it not being something that's trying to get a bunch of my information together and store it and use it and sell to advertisers. It's like that was like this realization. I mean, people forget like when the apps were launching from the App Store and game developers needed to know something about you so they could give you a currency balance of, you know, this virtual currency you're buying inside of your game or whatever it might have been, remembering sort of where you are at. They needed a unique identifier and they wanted to know more about you. And so everyone adopted this idea of Facebook Connect. And so Facebook Connect as an actual tool was included in the reported numbers that Facebook would talk about when they talked about their daily and monthly active users. And so it was a big part of the growth hack for Facebook. And so, you know, they saw that vision, they executed on it really, really well. The unfortunate part of that is just where all that information eventually ended up, unfortunately, you know, or just how easily, you know, some people who were operating in and around the space could take advantage of it. Web3 is restoring, you know, this idea of privacy, self-sovereignty. I don't have to give why should I have to tell everybody everything about me every time I want to do something on the internet? Like that's crazy as a concept. It was never intended for that. And so I think that Web3 login, that first experience for me, MetaMask and Uniswap, just as an example, there are lots now, like you go and you log into OpenSea with MetaMask and what have you, it does the same. But just that experience to me was like, oh my gosh, this is actually happening. Like that, I think when people do that, they'll be blown away at just how easy this thing can be. And so from a usability perspective, I think that's pretty cool. I think that's a mainstream play straight out of the gates. And I think that's going to push industry in a pretty major way. And so companies like Apple that talk about privacy, I think they very seriously need to think about what Web3 means for them.
Absolutely.
And then you said... favorite project? Oh, that's really tough. I mean, I think I'd have a degree of bias in this, just you know, by virtue of our relationship. True. Yeah. Look, I think a thing that, you know, when you get deep on anything and you sort of follow something, you know, down the path enough, or you get deeper into a community, you get excited. So, you know, one of our companies at Mycelium Lion's Mane is working very closely with Tracer DAO. on this Tracer product. And that's just, it's really cool for a whole host of reasons in terms of what it can potentially do. But the idea of infrastructure, you know, as a service, like the idea of permissionless launching of markets and these things, and also just the people who are contributing to the space as well. Like, you know, we've got all the brains trust of RMIT Blockchain Innovation Hub behind it, you know, some incredibly smart people as part of that that have spent decades researching some great stuff around governance. And I think just when you think about company governance alone, like there's some just neat things around that. It touches on legal frameworks. It touches on, you know, voting rights and stakeholder rights, and also just the community having a say. You know, I think there's just some fundamental things about that which are really cool. It's not the only one doing that, you know, in terms of DAOs and structures, but it's certainly one that I've had probably a little bit more exposure to. And just the idea that, you know, the automation and the tooling that can exist here that can then be available and accessible by your mainstream players, banks, neobanks, buy now, pay later companies, crypto exchanges. You know, there's a whole ton of companies that can be exposed to DeFi now through that sort of tooling. And I think that's going to be really important, is the idea that you don't have to be all in, you don't have to build everything. Like the idea that you can access these things is kind of neat, because this is when blockchain really delivers on its promises, delivering the tool sets to the industries that know what they want to do and how they're going to do it. They own the customer. They just need the technology. And once it's accessible to them, then everything changes. I mean, YouTube did that for video that everybody uses on their websites. You know, AWS did that in terms of scaling. You know, Twitter did that with their bootstraps too. People forget about that, how generous Twitter was to have done that with bootstrapping templates as well to build websites back in the day. But, you know, the idea of these frameworks for reducing the barriers to entry and launching to market, you know, using the best technology tool sets that are available, that's really cool. So for me, I'd probably say Tracer is probably where I'm watching and learning.
Awesome. I will get the link off of you, and I'll add those to the description for, you know, whoever wants to click on them and check them out. Thank you so much for being my first to answer the quick three.
Thank you. I don't know how quick they were, but I give you the answers all the same.
It's all right, Jake. They were quick enough, I'm sure. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
And that was the fascinating Jake Denny. Such an interesting journey so far. To me, it is really unsurprising that so many interesting characters end up working in crypto. It's a wonderful space to be working in right now, with so many ups and downs and lots of things happening. Amazing. All right, get in touch with Jake and check out Mycelium's website to find out more about what they do. All links are in the description for you. So tell me, what part of today's conversation resonated with you? Let me know in the comments or send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd really love to know what value are you getting from these conversations. Thanks for spending time with me. Hey, I'm already working on episode 42 for you. Yay! Until then, have an awesome time. I'll see you on the next block. Bye!